Hi, everyone. I am excited to welcome you to episode 358 of People Behind the Science. I'm Dr. Marie McNeely, and our guest joining me today is Dr. David Stern. Now, in our show, we give you a candid look inside the lives of scientists. And if there is a scientist who you would love to hear more about, let us know. Send us an email to contact@peoplebehindthescience.com, or you can reach out to us on Facebook or on Twitter at PBT Science. Now, today, David is going to tell you more about his life and the work he does at the Boyce Thompson Institute. So get ready to meet another one of our extraordinary people behind the science.
Every day, discoveries are made that will change our understanding of the world around us. Dr. Marie McNeely is here to bring you the brilliant minds who are making these discoveries so they can share their incredible stories and take you on an amazing journey. Welcome to People Behind the Science.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to People Behind the Science. Today, our guest is Dr. David Stern. So, David, welcome to our show. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
Wonderful. Well, we are excited to have you join us today. And listeners, just a little bit of background about David. He's the president of the Boyce Thompson Institute and adjunct professor of plant biology at Cornell University. He conducted his undergraduate studies at the University of California, Berkeley. He received his master's degree in biochemistry from Cambridge, and he was awarded his PhD in biological sciences from Stanford University. Afterward, David conducted postdoctoral research at the University of California, Berkeley, before accepting a position at the Boyce Thompson Institute, where he remains today. Now, David has been named a Fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, as well as a Fellow of the American Society of Plant Biologists for his distinguished and long-term contributions to plant biology. And David is here with us today to talk a little bit about his research, but also tell us about his journey through life and science. So, David, we want to hear it all today. We want you to share a little bit about yourself as a person, but also as a scientist. So can you start by talking about your life outside of science and how you spend your time?
Well, I probably do too many things, but one thing, my wife and I acquired a farm about 12 years ago. We farm about 175 acres and raise sheep and cattle, chickens, fruit, and sell at the farmer's market. And I really enjoyed learning to become a farmer. So I'm hands-on on the farm. I always walk around with grease and calluses on my hands. I'm also an ice hockey player. I play goalie for a group of hockey players here in Ithaca. And I raise a five-year-old son at the moment. He's five anyway. I have a lot of interests, but that's the main things outside of science.
Fantastic. So how do you balance the science, the farm, the hockey team, and the family?
I get that question a lot, and I tell people that everybody gets 24 hours in a day, and you got to decide how to use it.
Yeah, there's no secret sauce sometimes, I think.
No secret. Be organized.
Absolutely. So can you tell us a little bit about your scientific side next, and maybe the high-level view of what you tell people when they ask you what you do?
Yeah, I always tell them I have two jobs in science. One is basic studies of plants. In my lab, we study how plants use light energy to create the building blocks of life, photosynthesis, and things related to it. And then I tell them also that I run a plant research institute, and they usually ask what that is, and I tell them a little bit about Boyce Thompson Institute and how it's motivated by society's need to have a stable supply of food, but the way we work is really to understand how plants think.
I like it. That's interesting. So now tell us a little bit about your role as president of the Boyce Thompson Institute and maybe how that perhaps differs from the traditional faculty role.
It's very different. Faculty tend to build their individual silos, we sometimes call them. We try to coax them out of silos, but it's always a little bit lonely in a laboratory. But the idea of running and leading an institute is to have the whole be greater than the sum of the parts. So it's really leadership, which means getting people around you who are smarter than you are and giving them responsibility, and then being a motivator at a high level and somewhat of a visionary, although I don't mean that in too great of a sense. So it's a leadership role with a little bit of management mixed in.
Gotcha. So now tell us a little bit about the Boyce Thompson Institute next. I know the science is a huge part of it, but I think there's also an emphasis on communicating your results to the public.
That's right. If Boyce Thompson Institute is doing fundamental research on plants and hiding it away in a sort of ivory tower, we're not really doing our job.
Right.
The founder of the Institute wasn't even a scientist. He was an investor, actually, who thought that, again, food security was an important issue. This is now back in the 1920s. So if we're doing research, we need to talk to people about why we're doing it, how we're doing it, and how they can be involved. So we try to inspire the next generation of scientists by having outreach programs. We bring kids in for internships. We help teachers develop curricula so that they can familiarize all younger people with plant science. And there are people who want to support plant science who are excited about it, and we need to inform them and give them a chance to become involved. I think there's too big of a gap between the public and science in a general sense. I'm sure you're aware of that. And we're trying to do our part to bridge that gap and not be distant to the common person, people who aren't very familiar with the details of science or even scared of it, I guess.
Certainly. Well, I really appreciate your efforts in that vein. And it's great to hear a little bit more about where you work and the things that you're doing. And I think you mentioned you're juggling so many things right now. We talked a little bit about how to balance it. And I think being organized is key, but I think motivation is key as well for scientists. So can you tell us, David, do you have a favorite motivational or inspirational quote that keeps you going?
I don't know if it keeps me going, but the one that I tell people the most was one I heard from my father originally. And it's sexist. It says, a man's reach should exceed his grasp. That's a quote from Robert Browning's poem, Andrea del Sarto. Of course, today we wouldn't say a man's reach. We'd say anybody's reach should exceed their grasp. And I think that tells you that you should be reaching, but you shouldn't expect to get all the way. It's okay to fall short of a goal, but it's important to have goals that stretch you.
Absolutely. So are you one of these people that is constantly setting these big dream goals?
It doesn't have to be that big. In our leadership here at Boyce Thompson, we say, don't settle. Don't settle for anything. Always strive. Doesn't mean you have to stress yourself out, kill yourself. We're just saying, be adventurous, reach beyond where you think would be easy, and you'll be happier for it. And that's mainly what it means.
I like it. Fantastic quote to keep you going as a scientist. But I want to hear a little bit next about some of the people who may have kept you going as a scientist. So do you have any role models you can tell us about, or maybe some people who you really looked up to in your career?
I don't like the term role model, because a role model is someone that you emulate or you copy. And so I feel that I couldn't do what I do without inspiration from many others and teachings of many others. I don't really try to copy them. I try to learn from them. And some examples are the professor who was teaching a course that got me excited about research. That was a signature moment where I turned from a pre-med into a research scientist, at least in terms of career path. When I was a postdoc, another postdoc in the lab asked me a question about something that seemed kind of random, but when I look back, it changed completely the path of my research career. There was also a toad, a frog that got away when I was an undergraduate working in a lab, and that actually turned me into a plant scientist. So the toad was actually important in my career, but you wouldn't know that until you got there. So there's a lot of people I admire. I admire them for their ability to step back and see a problem from a high level, their ability to take themselves out of the equation and work for a community. Their brilliance in seeing a result or a discovery or some knowledge where I wouldn't see it. So people who are great mentors, I think you have to absorb from different types of people and different experiences to create your own self.
Absolutely. So I have to ask David about this toad that got away. Can you tell us how that turned you on to plant science?
Well, the same professor that inspired me to get into research, he taught about science not as a set of rote facts, but simply about how the process of discovery worked. So I asked him if I could work in his laboratory, and he used this toad, Xenopus laevis, as kind of a lab rat for some things. And we were working on what happens after eggs get fertilized, and unfortunately it involved sacrificing males to get their testes. And I never had to do it until one night when I was alone in the lab and I had to sacrifice this male toad, and it didn't work out too well. And it was kind of gross, actually. And after that, I decided I really couldn't work in animal science and I needed to do something else. And when I went to Cambridge as a master's student the next year, it was in a plant laboratory, and I kind of never looked back.
Gotcha. Well, I must say I had a similar experience with salamanders as well, and that made me turn towards human research. So now I work with people and it's great. But it's funny when you look back at what these huge moments were that maybe didn't seem like so big of a deal at the time.
It made me kind of squirmy, I gotta say, but I'll never forget it. I mean, this was a long time ago now. I can't remember somebody's name I met 5 minutes ago, but I'll never forget the toad.
Definitely. So now, can you tell us, you mentioned an influential professor when you were an undergraduate. Was there a moment before that where you can remember being interested in science, or where did this passion for science begin?
Well, I mean, if one looked at my family, you'd say, well, it must have come from your dad, because my dad was a university scientist. He was an academic, old school academic botanist. My sister and brother, however, didn't really have much interest in science. My sister was a scientific illustrator for a while, and she's a designer today. So I was exposed to research. I mean, I was born in that sense with a silver spoon in my mouth. I was around it. And my parents were very strong on sort of developing one's intellect. They weren't so interested in sports and that sort of thing. So I had that around me. But my mother was a physician. She's retired now. So I didn't know what I wanted to do when I went to college, but I figured it would have something to do with life. And I did start out as a pre-med, as I mentioned, but quickly grew disenchanted with that path. And then I was inspired by this professor. And then I had my father's experience to build on as I was a young scientist. I mean, I had a ready source of advice and inspiration and so on. I think it was very easy for me to become a scientist because of my family.
Certainly. So now you've shared some of the key moments that drew your attention to science. Can you tell us about some of these moments that maybe happened after that, that took you from that curious undergraduate getting interested in research to where you are today, president of this institute?
Well, sometimes people say, how did you plan your career? Or what are your future plans? And I don't know. Isn't life what happens while you're making plans? So that's kind of how my life has worked. I mentioned the toad that made me into a plant scientist. And then because of that, another postdoc walked into the lab that same year and said, what are you doing after you graduate from college? I'd been in school for so long, just like the rest of us. I hadn't even remembered that it was going to end. It sounds really naive, but you don't think about it. I don't think about those things. Mm-hmm. So we said, you should go to England and do a postdoc like I did. And it turned out nobody from Berkeley had done that in decades on this particular fellowship. And I ended up getting the fellowship and going to this plant lab. And while I was there, I met another postdoc who changed my mind about where I was going to go to graduate school. I'd already signed up to go to Cornell, and I ended up at Stanford. And there I met somebody else who asked me, got me started on a project that gave an unexpected result. And that's how my life has worked. So I picked UC Berkeley for a postdoc because of a girlfriend that I ended up breaking up with before I even started as a postdoc. So this is how my life has worked. When I got to Boyce Thompson, I mean, I was kind of a long hair from the West Coast. I certainly wasn't leadership material. But as things turned out, I was the last man left standing a couple of times and ended up as a president. And so I kind of embraced that opportunity to, I don't know, to move my career forward, to learn new skills, to try to be a bigger picture thinker and maybe give back a little bit to the system that nurtured me, the scientific system. I often tell people that granting agencies, foundations, universities, research institutes, they aren't there by chance, they're there by design. So somebody has those ideas, somebody executes on those bigger picture ideas, and I'm really privileged to be part of that. You have to give up something. You have to give up some of your own personal research agenda for the community, but I'm happy to do that. I'm lucky to be able to do that.
Definitely. Well, interesting to hear more about your story, David. And I know, in addition to your leadership role there, you do maintain active research, and I'm curious to hear about one of these projects that you have going on now that you are so excited to be working on.
One of the most amazing things about doing this president job and having a lab is that I can still get excited about little things that happen in the laboratory. It's kind of satisfying, even though I spend a lot of time talking about big picture stuff. Right now, we have these corn plants that we've engineered that actually grow faster than normal corn plants because we've increased their ability to absorb carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. It's kind of nice on two levels. One is because our ability to do that, we weren't trying to make corn plants grow faster. We were just trying to understand how plants make the enzyme that absorbs CO2 from the atmosphere. So that ability to parlay a basic discovery into something, how do you say, visceral, the plant that actually grows faster, is kind of cool. It's kind of the translation of discovery. And then the other is that I personally feel like humanity's biggest challenge is climate change. It has so many sides to it. But the central driver of climate change is carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. If these plants that can make carbon dioxide go away faster and climate change is important. And so there's a little bit of a connection there between the discovery and something important in society.
Certainly. So now, do you at the Institute see some of these exciting discoveries then through to translation, or do you focus more on the basic side of research?
That's something that we've addressed in our strategic planning over the years because it's a really common question that supporters ask, that our board of directors ask. And the answer is that we kind of see it as a triangle, not an equilateral triangle, but a very long isosceles triangle, if you will. And the higher end of the vertical side is the basic research, and then the little point at the far end is the applied research. So we welcome our faculty to work along that continuum of basic to applied, but in general, we're more heavily focused on the basic end. So for example, for my work on these faster growing corn plants, I'm going to St. Louis next week, as I mentioned, to talk to a company who's interested in using that technology and applying it to the kind of corn seeds that are sold to farmers. And they're better suited to do that, quite frankly. But they wouldn't invest in the kind of discovery that we made that led to this because it's too high of a risk for a private company.
Definitely. So do you find these interactions then with the industry side of things challenging? Is it difficult? I know a lot of scientists come through with a purely academic training, so it's hard to maybe make that transition or speak the same language as these people.
That's right. Well, industry isn't monolithic. On one level, it's scientists just like us. I mean, I would say at least half of Boyce Thompson's postdocs go to industry jobs as opposed to academic jobs. So the scientists speak the same language. What the drivers of what a company does, though, are what scientists kind of puzzle to understand. And one thing as president, I've become much more fluent in is technology transfer. And we try to expose our postdocs and graduate students to technology transfer, how that process works, why patenting exists, and so on. Until you've dipped your toe a little bit into that water, it is hard to understand what motivates companies and how they make their decisions. But for me personally, it's a lot less of a black box than it used to be.
Certainly. So now we've talked a little bit about the exciting elements of your career and what you're doing now, but I want to talk next about some of these challenges. So you mentioned that there are challenges every day as a scientist, just in terms of balancing your life, balancing all the things you need to do. But I think all of us have dark days in science. There are things that we've failed at. There are challenges that we face that we really are struggling to get through. So can you take us back to a time in your own career where you really struggled with something, or maybe you had a major failure, David, and tell us what happened and how you got your way through it to be successful?
I like that question, but I had so many failures that I lost count of them probably 30, 40 years ago.
Yeah, it's better not to count them, I think.
Yeah, what's a major failure and a minor failure? I don't really even know. But I guess I feel like I'm pretty good at picking myself up and dusting myself off, in science at least. You really just have to take the long view and get a good night's sleep. I guess I would say that in science, as you point out, there's so much rejection. Your manuscripts, your grants, fellowship you applied for, somebody you want to meet with isn't available. You kind of have to have a sense of humor, take it in stride. Sometimes things just don't seem fair. So I would say for me, at this stage of my career, I'm kind of used to that school of hard knocks, or soft knocks and hard knocks, but the challenge is really helping other people through their disappointment and discouragement, either people you're mentoring or your staff. Because not everybody just bounces back from what you're calling failure. I think disappointment or discouragement is maybe closer. Failure seems so absolute. Every scientist, as you point out, is convinced sometime or other, maybe multiple times, that their career was falling apart. I remember that in graduate school. I remember it as a postdoc. I remember it as a scientist. There are all those moments where everything just seems to have fallen through some black hole. So I'm at a point now where obviously I'm secure in my position. I'm a very fortunate person. But not everybody around me feels the same way. And I think my job is really to help them through those times, to help them see what their path should be or could be.
Well, I like that description there, David. And you mentioned these moments where you feel like your career is falling apart. And I think that's a really great way to describe it. The world just seems to be crumbling around you. And for any of our listeners out there who might be young scientists in this position themselves, do you have maybe a description that you can give them of what happened in your case and how you decided to keep going?
Well, there was a quote I was going to mention to you sometime later. This is from Yogi Berra. He said, when you get to a fork in the road, take it. And so every day is a fork in the road. Maybe you're getting a message from this disastrous situation. Maybe it's telling you something, or maybe it's just one of those things. Just three things happened on the same day and you have to shake it off. Or is it a sign? And one has to have an open mind, look at it. For example, in biology, six people receive a PhD. One of them goes into academia. The other five go and do something else. That's not failure, but a lot of people look at it as failure. So it's how you define success and failure that's important. And everybody has a talent. Everybody has a path, maybe multiple paths. And I think we have to just accept that it's not always the path that we thought it was.
Sure. Now, tell us a little bit more about success. I think scientists need to celebrate success every moment they get a chance, whether it's these big successes or even these small victories along the way, because sometimes they are few and far between. So, David, I want to give you a chance to tell us about one of your successes that meant a lot to you.
Well, and not sort of a little success would be we had a manuscript published. Actually, I think it's getting published a week from today in the Journal of Biological Chemistry, and they made it paper of the week. So it's the top 2% of their papers. And we were excited about these results that are in this paper because they were a surprise to us. We actually found something we weren't looking for, which is the aha moment everybody waits for in science. And it's nice to have our peers think about it that way as well. I've had some bigger successes, I would say, around trying to unify the plant science community around some common goals to build consensus within a very large and diverse community of scientists. So a couple of years ago, we published a document called the Decadal Vision for Plant Science, which has been used a lot of places to help plan for the future and conceive new programs. To the extent, I was just one of many people involved in it, but I thought that was exciting that we can build consensus among a very large community of people who are so different.
So can you tell us a little bit about what that process was like? Was it just a series of meetings? Did you all get together? How did they select who is going to be working together to put these goals together?
Yeah, this is one of these didn't plan it stories, but the American Society for Plant Biologists has a group that made a decision before I was involved to convene something called the Plant Summit back in 2011. And that group was supposed to build consensus around what the future of plant science looked like. And in fact, the group was an interesting group of people. I was part of a group, it was about 140, but they didn't build consensus. And I had just learned how to do strategic planning because of work at Boyce Thompson. So I had been taught strategic planning. We came up with a strategic plan. And to me, it looked like a strategic plan with no strategy, the output from this first plant summit. And I was one of the several people who were frustrated with the result because the intent was right, but the result couldn't really be used. And so I guess being a complainer, I was tapped to lead the second stage of that. So I convened the second plant summit that was much smaller and a very different constitution of people. So we spent a couple of days with the facilitator talking about the results from the first summit and thinking about it as a strategic plan. And then I led the writing of the document, which is, I said, called the Decadal Vision for Plant Science, which the ASPB, the American Society for Plant Biologists, published in 2013. I and a number of other people have taken it through Congress. We've taken it to policymakers in other places, to federal officials, to universities, and showed them that there's exciting things to do in plant science, how central it is to our well-being and our societal challenges. So that's been a really interesting process. It's really about unifying a community and finding the right people to bring together who can build consensus on behalf of others.
Well, I know it can be hard even within a lab to have consensus on what the priorities are and where you're going next. So this is a huge accomplishment, being able to get the field together and get to consensus on what the priorities are.
Well, that work hasn't stopped yet. And last year, the National Science Foundation funded a grant that I'm the principal investigator on for something called the Research Coordination Network. And from that, we formed the Plant Science Research Network, or PSRN. And the PSRN is so far 12 scientific societies and growing, ranging from the Council for Undergrad Research to the Ecological Society of America, the Horticulture Society, and so on. 12 scientific societies that have plant scientists all getting together to run workshops, to write documents on the future of plants, and to get to know each other. So I enjoy this community building. It's a big challenge, and it's hard to know how successful it will be in terms of impact. But I think it's an important activity for us as a community to know who each other are, what we care about, and to learn from each other.
It sounds like you are making excellent progress. So thank you so much for sharing these stories of success with us today, David. And we chatted a little bit about your life outside of science. And I know for me, one of the things I'm trying to squeeze in more and more into my life is time to sit down, relax with a book. So can you share with us today, David, a book that you've read and really enjoyed that my listeners or myself can pick up to read?
Sure. I was going to mention two books. So one of them is in this area of getting to know your food. So I like Barbara Kingsolver's book, Animal Vegetable Miracle, just because she's such an engaging author. And she spent a year trying to figure out how farming works. I really enjoyed that book. I know there's a lot of books by Michael Pollan. I've read some of his. I think they're a little more politicized than Barbara Kingsolver's. Doesn't mean they're bad books, but I liked hers more. I'm also reading a book called Bad Dirt by Annie Proulx. It's really about hardscrabble life, the kind of life that a lot of farmers have lived and live today, cowboys, farmers, and so on. And I guess I like it because I farm. And I think scientists sometimes forget about real life, especially plant scientists. They think they're doing something for farmers, but they really don't know what it's like to be a farmer. And Annie Proulx's writing really makes it come to life.
Fantastic recommendations. Well, I will add A Vegetable, Animal Miracle, and Bad Dirt to our reading list for our listeners to find there. Now, you mentioned this, kind of getting a sense of what life is like as a farmer. Is this something that you at the Boyce Thompson Institute do? Do you engage with farmers to kind of learn a little bit more about what their pain points and challenges are?
We're kind of two steps away from farmers. And one of the first things I did with farmers is the American Farm Bureau asked me to come and give an address to their group about the genetic engineering of plants a few years ago as they were planning their positioning for the Farm Bill. So farmers as individuals, they don't have a strong connection with researchers like us. They're kind of middlemen. Some of the middlemen are the things like the organizations like the Farm Bureau, but also the seed companies, the companies that are starting to produce, I don't know, microbiome treatments for agriculture. So the consumers of the research, the direct consumers, tend to be the commercial entities that are going to translate it to farmers. There's relatively little direct interaction except in one area, which is Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which has funded a lot of agriculture research for developing countries. In those cases, our scientists often travel to Africa to speak directly with farmers and policymakers there. But in this country, usually you meet with the middleman.
Gotcha. Well, good to know a little bit more about the process. And this response, you mentioned some of these opportunities for travel that scientists have. And I think this is one of the wonderful aspects of the career. So David, can you think back now on all the places that science has taken you and tell us about your favorite travel memory, where you were and what happened?
One thing I always encourage my faculty to do, they don't always take me up on it, is to take sabbaticals. So sabbatical is generally every seventh year, you can take a year off. and go somewhere else. And I always hear excuses like my lab will fall apart or my son's daughters are in school. But I think my dad and mom took me on a sabbatical. I lived in Denmark for a year when I was in grade school, and it changed my life. And it was just such a wonderful experience. So I wanted to make sure I took sabbaticals when I was a scientist. And my first sabbatical was in Paris. And it was a game changer from the science point of view. From what I learned there was hands-on genetics that I didn't know how to do. But I also met my future wife. So that's what made it so memorable.
Wonderful. So how long were you in Paris?
A year.
Gotcha. Were there certain sites that you remember in Paris fondly?
I liked the markets and the bakeries. The food there, we talk about food in America. Now there's more artisanal food than there used to be, but the French really know how to enjoy their food. And of course, Paris is full of art museums, famous sites. Everywhere you go, it's like reading a history book. I mean, it's an incredible thing.
Sure. I know I only spent a few days in Paris, sort of on the tail end of a conference trip, and just the fresh baguettes with cheese. Sometimes it was just the simple things that left such an outstanding impression.
Absolutely.
Well, wonderful to hear about one of these travel opportunities, and lovely to hear that that is where you met your future wife. So fantastic to hear about some of these places science has taken you. But I think not only do scientists get to meet wonderful people when they're traveling, you also have wonderful colleagues that you're working with in your laboratories at home. And I think the people are some of the things that make science so great. And I know all the labs that I've talked to oftentimes have funny traditions or just quirky memories or things that they've done together that are a lot of fun. And I think this sort of contrary to some of the stereotypes that are out there about what scientists are like. So David, can you share a story of your own that shows the human side of science with one of these funny memories or quirky traditions?
I think about this Paris lab that I spent a year in, because one reason to go abroad, of course, is cultural immersion. And I think every young scientist, really every young person, should have an international experience or more than one international experience. We never learn how rich the cultures of the world are. Anyway, in this Paris lab, there was a postdoc who made the best tiramisu on the planet. She was Italian, and she made everything from scratch, from the lady fingers on up. So anytime there was an important celebration, it started with tiramisu and ended with wine. And that was a great lab tradition. I don't know if it's quirky or not, but it's certainly memorable.
So do you have any traditions that are ongoing now at the Boyce Thompson Institute or within your own laboratory?
Well, I'm not really in my laboratory. I just can't spend enough time there to have traditions.
Gotcha. They may have traditions without you at this point.
But yesterday we had our annual ice cream social for the whole institute, where the leadership team scoops the ice cream, because we have our whole summer intern group here, and everybody turns out for ice cream, as you can imagine. And so that's a nice tradition.
I love it. Well, fantastic traditions. And I love sharing these traditions. I think it gives young faculty members good ideas for things that they can develop in their own laboratories too. So now we've talked about some of the research questions that you are working to answer and your colleagues are working to answer at the Boyce Thompson Institute, but I do want to hear about these big questions that remain in your mind. I think every scientist has at least a few that are just these burning questions that you would love to answer if you didn't have things standing in the way. So if we took out the issues with funding, staff, technology, feasibility, all the barriers that you normally face as a scientist, David, is there one question that you are dying to know the answer to?
That's a question we usually ask our faculty interviewees. So these postdocs, core postdocs that come in to get grilled for 2 or 3 days. Mm-hmm. And scientists have been so beaten into thinking incrementally by the granting agencies and so on and by their peers. So when you ask somebody about take away all these barriers to success, their answer is like, what?
Deer in headlights. Yeah.
But right. So I don't know if there's one question, but I do have a question. It's part of the answers from these decadal vision type of exercises. And I phrase it very simply. Why do plants make 400,000 unique chemicals? It's pretty amazing that they do, but they do it for a reason. So we need 400,000 answers. I think that would take a few dollars in staff.
Yeah. So how would you even go about starting to tackle that question? Do you start with a few of the chemicals and try and figure out why, or?
Well, that's a really good question. So these days, we do a lot of broad scale things like sequencing and proteomics. So we need broad screens to just understand what the diversity of chemicals is. And then we need to ask the plant why it makes it. I think that's the most interesting question. Yes, some of them are going to be anti-cancer compounds. Some of them will have other properties that we can take advantage of. But they're made for a reason. It's usually got to do with some environmental challenge they have. Could be an insect. It could be something in the soil. And that's just fascinating how plants have achieved and employ this kind of chemical diversity. It's a whole language of plants that we barely have scratched the surface of understanding. And yet, most of our important medicines actually come from plant-derived compounds. So there's a lot to be learned there that I think it would be worth a big investment.
Definitely. Well, that is an excellent question. And I had no idea myself, I will admit, that plants made quite that many compounds. So very impressive. So now, David, we talked about different elements of your career in your career path, and I think there are a lot of people that you encounter along your journey who are great sources of advice. Can you share with our listeners today, who may be on their own scientific journey, one piece of advice that really had a big impact on you or was just the best advice that you remember?
Don't try to change people.
Ooh, that's good. What was the context?
Lots of context. Relationships, employees, students. Everybody has talents, as I said before. We all know that. And sometimes we forget that we can't choose what other people's innate qualities are, nor should we try to change them. So innate qualities are things by definition that we can't change. So we have to think about everybody's strengths and desires. And if they don't fit with the situation, I think we have to admit it. But I think we have to try to appreciate people for who they are, not what we wish they were.
I think that is fantastic advice. And I think it's important for people to think about maybe as they're beginning to assemble their laboratory or their group. I mean, you can certainly help people grow and develop as people, as scientists, but ultimately you can't change those fundamental characteristics. So,
right. And so building a scientific lab or building a research institute, it's about essentially building a family. And when you think about how much time you spend in a laboratory, especially as a young scientist, compared to how much time you spend anywhere else, including with your family, it's a pretty dominant situation. And it is fraught because there is so much failure. So a lot of times we simply look at a resume and ask how good a person is. But there are a lot of other qualities that go into achieving your goals of excellence, discovery, or whatever they are that go a lot farther than a resume. And I think it's always a challenge to get people to look beyond the resume and to find ways to assess people beyond a resume that are meaningful. So that's one of the leadership challenges we face here every day.
Certainly. And I think there are certain characteristics, even like resilience or perseverance, that are sort of hard to demonstrate on a resume. So,
and if you ever looked at letter of reference, the only gradation is from A+ to A++ to A++++. Mm-hmm. And so it is hard. It's very hard for an interviewee and it's very hard for an interviewer.
Gotcha. Well, fantastic advice, David. Now, is there any other last piece of advice or a last note of inspiration that you want to leave our listeners with today?
Well, I would say do what you love and love to do lots of different things.
Very simple. Very well said. I like it. Listeners, take this advice to heart. And David, now, if our listeners want to learn more about you and the work that you do at the Boyce Thompson Institute, where should they go?
They can go to Boyce Thompson's website, easy enough to find, or they can contact me at ds, like David Stern, 28 at cornell.edu. Love to hear from people. Any question is a good question.
Fantastic. Well, listeners, definitely learn more about the fantastic research going on at Boyce Thompson Institute and reach out to David if you have any questions. David, thank you so much for joining us today for an interview.
Pleasure was mine.
Well, it was a joy to speak with you as well. And listeners, thank you for joining us. We'll see you next time on another episode of People Behind the Science. Your voyage to explore the lives of today's exceptional scientists has just begun. You can find everything we talked about today, including our guests' favorite books, biographies, photos, and more, when you visit us at www.peoplebehindthescience.com. I look forward to chatting with you next time on People Behind the Science.